Welcome all to another episode of Spaghetti Code, and you know, another one in English, as we are getting accustomed to for this season. It's a great pleasure for us to have Martin Kearns today on the show. He's an agile pioneer, actually. I'll give you, Martin, the opportunity to introduce yourself a bit better for our audience.
Yeah. Okay. So my name's Martin. I was a software developer in Ireland. I went over to watch a football match in Scotland, met a girl at a bar, and I ended up moving to Australia. And when I came to Australia, you know, you try to find ways to be different, to be more, you know, marketable. And I was working for someone at the time, and they just said, you're going to be a UML expert. Go and buy a book in UML and learn it.
And UML.
Craig Larman wrote one of the signatories that book, and he made a small reference to Agile in the book, and I started chasing it. I found it interesting. I asked my boss if I could do it. I was told no. I did it anyway. He found out later, and you know, he asked me why I should be fired, and I explained because I gave him $1 million account, and maybe you should figure out what I've been doing. And he said it was a good answer. And yeah, so from 2005, you know, Agile is all I've been doing, and it's kind of part of who I am at this stage. And yeah, I love it. I've loved being, you know, if I Googled or YouTube Scrum Master, I'd get nothing back. So I really was trying to understand and find ways to make things work before there were any rules or precedent. And I actually found it a little bit easier than today, because sometimes I think we're our own worst enemies. We put rules on ourselves that don't need to be there. So I seem to be undoing some of that by saying, well, that's not how I did it. I don't know why it's been making it so hard for yourself.
That's so interesting, actually. Yeah, as you said, I mean, I think as an industry, we put, you know, we make up, you know, many rules on top of maybe such a straightforward way of working, which, you know, should be, I guess, dynamic and flexible as possible, actually. I'm really interested, actually, in understanding better, you know, we on the show, myself and Marco, often have talked about Agile. We've done it in Italian because we believe that in Italy there's not as much, I guess, opportunity to work in, you know, using Agile methodologies as much as we have found, you know, abroad, mainly because maybe we just think we know what the Italian, you know, scene is like, just because we have not spent a lot of our...
I did my first Agile project in Italy, and just outside the University of Toronto in 2012.
Oh, right. Okay. That's brilliant.
So there was some interest back then. And, you know, I think we can, you know, I think we can always make our life harder by saying, oh, it doesn't align to our culture, or, yeah, this part of the world where we don't have strong internet, we can't do what... If you look in every shape and form, there's some form of Agile that exists, and they mightn't even know it that way. I mean, look how an Italian grandmother cooks pasta. How many times is there a taste test? You know, there's lots of ways in which we go about our world not trying to do something like yesterday. And we evolve our problems to solve the problem. You know, you'll find it everywhere. If you go in with a big list of we must do, well, it's going to be very hard to start.
Absolutely.
I think it's much easier to start at the beginning and just do something small and see what happens. I think you can do literally do any Agile anywhere. Probably the only place that you might be able to do it very well in is a barista, because I think that's I think there's certain people are very stuck in their ways in how you make good coffee. I don't think I'll ever win an argument for telling an Italian I think you'd change the way you make coffee. So other than that, I think there's lots of places.
And actually, this is very, very interesting because what I noticed in the market in general is that many companies have confused Agile, which is a set of principles, right, with the tools themselves or the process that they use. So, for instance, they confuse Agile and Scrum, right?
Yeah.
And how one, they, in my opinion, it's sometimes the confusion is that what power was, you know, and what is the behind what we are doing. So what is your opinion about it? What is Agile, you know, what does it mean?
Yeah, for me, my definition of Agile is that Agile is the way in which we evolve and adapt to solve a problem over trying to reframe a problem to suit the way we prefer to work. That's it. There's nothing more than that. It's the way for us to make sure we don't just use bad habits again and again, because that's what we're most comfortable with. If the problem moves, the way we work has to move with it. And if you can do that, well, then you can do Agile.
That's great, actually. That's a great definition. And I guess you have a lot of experience with companies that, you know, believe there's only one way of approaching problems and solving
them. Yeah. Well, to be honest with you, the companies that have that belief are the ones that I'm probably least attracted to.
Fair enough. Okay.
At the moment, I'm helping organizations with Agile to make 3D dresses, to create customized planning tools, to financial payments, and to working with children within juvenile courts. Like the problem, they're pretty varied, and what I like is the fact that I can't go into any one of them and just do what I did yesterday.
Yeah. Like, great point.
You know, you kind of, your context, which means that you have to embrace the environment, embrace the subculture. I find that anyone who tells me how I must work or what I must do or what I must do next, they don't need me. My job is to question all that. So they're not even attracted to using a coach, definitely not wanting to work with an enterprise coach, because my mandate is asking, what are the macro forces that are forcing you to adapt? Where's your? I'm trying to work with people who've at least see that there's a problem coming or that they're struggling.
You know, the company that comes to you and seek for your help, what they're looking for in general. I mean, do you see a pattern between those companies? I guess, you know, you mentioned a few different sectors, fields.
Yeah.
But is there any pattern that you can see between those companies, even if they operate in different environments?
Yeah, I think the biggest pattern of success for me is when a senior executive can articulate a threat that they're concerned about. It could either be a competitor threat, regulatory or compliance threats, and scaling constraints. Like, I get a lot of work where a startup, so you can't be a startup forever. And if you're 120 people, you can't call yourself a startup. There's anything but, whether you like it or not, there's a degree of bureaucracy. The owner of that business won't speak to everybody every day. In fact, he won't know everyone's name. So you're not a startup. So how are you going to change your ways of working when you're not a startup? And in fact, trying to hold on to the ethos of what you did as a startup holds you back from scaling. If you can articulate where your problem is, I feel Agile can help solve it. But if you don't have a problem, you don't need me. So I think to answer your question, I think a leader who's really articulate in what the problem is, and there's a shared understanding of that with their direct reports, I think you're onto a winner.
So this is an interesting point, and you made me sort of realize that actually, you know, if companies are coming to you, they are probably mature enough to kind of know what they're looking for and what they expect from an agile sort of input.
They don't necessarily know what they're looking for. I think what they for example, how do you interview somebody when you're not good at what you're interviewing them on? You don't have a base knowledge. Well, how do you interview? So for me, I think the way that people make those type of decisions of who to use, it's how you're able to get them to kind of resonate with the problem, or how you can kind of, predict, or you can assume kind of some of the problems that have already happened. So if I can create some kind of resonance with what has already happened or what they're struggling with, just based off the questions I've asked, well, then I think they feel that you're probably, you're good at listening, and you probably have a decent kind of next move. I don't prescribe to have all the answers. What I do think is that I'll be able to find the solution faster than most.
Brilliant. Okay, fair enough.
I've had this analogy with Agile, which works for me.
Okay.
It just works for me. So I like certain organizations. They look like a square. Others look like a rectangle. Others look like a triangle. Others like a circle, and some just ugly blobs that you would never be able to describe as a shape. Agile is something which you place into the center of every single one of those shapes, and you grow and stretch to fit the shape of the organization. So as long as you can create your center point, you will evolve and grow to suit the subculture of a business, to suit the conditions of the industry. Then everything else will work out. But if you are trying to go in saying, hey, you're a circle company, but I can make you a square, and I can make you a square really quickly because I'm going to Spotify you, or I'm going to save your life, then you're not really working within the organization, are you? You're just lifting and shifting your experience.
This is really interesting to me because I working day to day with engineering teams and product and the rest of the stakeholders, at times there are things that I can consider, external constraint that kind of make it harder for my teams to work, in an agile way. In those circumstances, I kind of default to the thinking that we need to change something. We need to change,
You don't need to change anything until you start measuring something. So whatever problems you're referring to, how well are you measuring? What's the impact? Like, are you calling them impediments? Are you giving them a financial number? Are you tracking the length of time they exist? Are you able to kind of have a multiplier of error? Like, what are you doing to make your problems real to everybody, not just to you? Are you just talking in acronyms? Have you turned it into common language? I mean, all of those are opportunities to do something different before you have to make change. I think the observer effect is probably the most powerful thing that Scrum gave us. And it's the one that most people don't use, which is call an impediment, start to measure its behavior, create trends around its impact. And when it reaches thresholds, tell people sooner rather than later. That's anybody can do that.
Absolutely. And I'm kind of getting close to in my thinking to, I guess, the heated argument. You mentioned Scrum. I guess you have a lot of experience with Scrum. And as I think our industry tends to put Scrum versus Kanban versus other type of frameworks, they put them in contrast.
Yeah, I think it's more, look, I think the Kanban, so look, I've used Kanban since I've started.
Yeah.
And I've used Scrum from the beginning. And I never thought these two were in competition, right? Absolutely. And I didn't even know there was a thing called Scrumban. And then when I read the book, it was like, okay, I didn't think this wasn't mind shifting. where I think we have a problem in the Agile community is lots of people trying to compete against one another.
Yeah.
And saying my way is better than your way. Right. They're just techniques. And all of the aggression that I ever see on LinkedIn in particular is always from the authors or from people whose consulting is based off just doing one thing.
Fair enough.
One of the things that I always enjoy was I was part of the Scrum coaching accreditors, and we used to like review Scrum applicants for the CEC. We used Kanban to manage that process. We used Kanban to manage the Scrum accreditation process, right? And we didn't seem to have a problem with doing that. So where does these animosities come from? Just people trying to make money, people trying to say I'm better than you, people trying to create power. So I hate the fragmentation that occurs within Agile because of ego. And so I try not to get caught in it, because it's almost all contradictory to the word Agile, right?
Absolutely, yeah. And do you have some like recommendations for like the teams out there that maybe, I guess, they don't know what, you know, how to frame their Agile way of work? Should they frame it within a specific framework? What are the things that you look for to be able to make a decision as to what elements to adopt as part of your team culture?
Well, I mean, I think the first thing that you need to frame are what are the principles you're working to. And I think it's really important that we describe what a principle means. A principle is something where we're consciously incompetent. When I write a principle, it's because I'm saying I need to get better at this because I'm not really good at it. A principle is to bring something to the front of our minds that we're then going to try and resolve. Once I have accepted what is the principle that we're really working towards, the practices and methods that are going to support that principle can come from wherever. If you haven't a clue what those principles are, Scrum's a good start because it forces you to ask some reflective questions on a periodic basis. You know, I find, like, I've worked with Kanban teams and I've introduced a Scrum cycle, which is like six weeks or 2 months. And it was around system change. The sprint was a system change. It wasn't work. And it was about, was there degrees of automation. It was, you know, it was all sorts of different things, but it was things that you just don't make a change in a day on. And it was, you know, they wanted to have a continuous improvement cycle. And, you know, a 2 week sprint was too fast. And they said, how about six? And I went, okay, well, just so what? Let's go with it. I've heard somebody stand at a conference and go and say, I went to this company one day and they told me that they work a 6 week sprint. Could you believe it? And everyone's laughing. And I'm kind of going, have you asked what context that was in? You're just judging it based off a standard. Maybe they were a Kanban team who just were using Scrum to evolve. Maybe they were making skyscrapers. Who knows? You can't judge without context.
This is great. Yeah, absolutely. I totally agree.
Yeah, there's way too many assholes in the Agile community. That's one.
And actually, you know, talking about not talking about assholes, talking about teams. You know, so I was wondering if you saw, you know, what you have a lot of experience of helping teams to move towards an agile principle way of working, right? So did you see any specific function of the team that are kind of more reluctant to take over those, or, you know, they are all equal, or is mostly depending on the company culture?
No. I think the biggest problem we have with agile is that agile accelerates groupthink. So, you know, one of the great things about agile is it creates strongly formed teams. One of the worst things about Agile, it creates strongly formed teams that leads to groupthink. So if the Scrum Master can't given an opposing view, if a member of the team can't challenge with safety, well, then you're never going to become a high-performing team. The team is already reached its glass ceiling, which is stay within this limit and don't move beyond it. What's the difference between that and bullying? So I think a lot of teams think they're great because they're very strongly formed. But if you see any dissent or any challenge, the way that they become so defensive, aggressive, dismissive, you don't have an agile team. You've got a team that's going in the wrong direction, which is now not able to listen to anybody else. That's my biggest. I think if you can make sure that there's harmony in what we call creative tension, then you're fine. But if creative tension can't be maintained because it's unsafe to do so, well, then you've already started going down a slippery slope.
Okay. And do you have any suggestion, to avoid those traps?
Yeah. One of the things I like to do is to one of my favorites is to have a devil's advocate role, in every meeting, there's somebody who is going to ask a question that will challenge what we've been saying. So they have to either just disagree. They have to say, what haven't we considered? That's one. The other one that I've liked to do is I've always had the customer chair. And then at the end of a meeting, what would the customer say about our conversation? So they would be the two that I like to bring in is a concept of in coaching, we call it the third person chair. I just try and give that chair a name. So sometimes it's the system we're going to ask from, customer, the devil's advocate, depending on the team, all of those could be quite valid. I think you have to create something which you look at to break eye contact from one another. So why I like the third chair is because we both look at the chair and then talk to the chair rather than just keep talking to one another. So I like to try and depersonalize the tension.
That makes me think, and sorry for the digression, it doesn't... I don't know if this is going to be any useful to our audience, but you make me think of when I used to practice Aikido. The master used to tell us, do not look the opponent in the eye, because otherwise you're going to get sort of locked to both your egos. Instead, keep looking forward and be detached from your ego, and don't have that kind of tension. Just move forward, independent, which is, I think, it's a really powerful way of looking at things.
Yeah, I mean, there's a lot of concepts in Agile that are all based off Japanese origins. Yeah. I think the thing about teams is that we have to remember that they're very fragile. Right, they're not. They can. Lots of things can make a team go from being productive to unproductive within 48 hours. So for me, if we're able to become vulnerable to that, right, then I think we ask better questions of ourselves. So I try, one of the things I talk about is if someone got hit by a bus, would we be able to perform as well tomorrow as we are today? And if not, why not? Some people think that's a bit of a negative way of looking at it. So I said, okay, well, let's play. I like scenario planning a little bit. So I play a scenario where, Marco isn't going to be able to do any podcast for 2 months. So what happens next? If the answer is, okay, we won't be doing any podcasts for 2 months, well, I wouldn't say that's a very robust team. I'd be going, okay, well, who's next? Who's next to join? Who's the second Marco? Well, then the podcast is stronger than one individual. So I think that you kind of have to look at the same with teams. Teams are fragile and they can be they can break down within days. So we should be feeling always somewhat vulnerable and asking questions around how are we trying to become more resilient?
That's interesting. And you mentioned the concept of high performing teams as well. I wonder, you know, sometimes like there is tension that, you know, takes, I guess, the high from high performing, you know, away from time to time. Like, how can teams sort of continuously stay high performing? And maybe even before that, what's the definition of a high performing team?
So I think a high performing, for me, the first thing about a high performing team is that there's a there's a concept called interdependency, that there's a belief system that we're interdependently related, which means I can't achieve success without you achieving success. So if my task is done and your task isn't, well, then it's irrelevant to all of us. So how do you have interdependence within the group so that all work is shared equally and valued equally? And you might be, because that, the second thing then is that if you believe in interdependency, well, then you would believe in asking for help whenever you need it. A high-performing team knows when to ask help rather than wait. Alistair Coburn created a concept in one of his earlier books called Erg Seconds. As the amount of time it takes a person to go and seek help, if the person is beside them, to have to walk up a flight of stairs, if they have to, you know, wait for a new time zone, how long would somebody be willing to sit in absence of a decision, in absence of knowing what to do, before they'd have the desired task? A high-performing team, it should take minutes to ask that question.
This is interesting also in light of, you know, remote working being more and more, I guess, a common way of working. Do you think that has, like, what kind of impact do you think that has on existing teams? And you mentioned time zones as well. Are there, I don't know, new ways of addressing this?
Well, I think some remote teams are some of the highest performing teams I know. And the main reason why is because their Slack channels, their instant chat, are continuously being used. You can see a high performing team that is remote by just looking at their chat flows, by looking at the amount of updates on their mirror boards, by, you know, just seeing the commentary in their Jira ticket, by seeing how Confluence is being used. The remote teams know that the way that they have to kind of store and retain knowledge has to be accessible to everybody. And I think they do a really good job at it. I think you can create the same kind of, like, I've worked with teams that are completely remote, and the main reason why is because the team consists of people from Shanghai to Bangalore to Hong Kong to Singapore, Melbourne, Sydney, and Bangladesh. So we could never, you know, it takes a little bit longer to form a team. It takes, you know, I think you can't do it without a very strong scrum master or restoration manager kind of trying to build a sense of purpose together. But it is possible. I think you can accelerate the storming phase by bringing people in together for a couple of weeks. But it's, you know, for me, it's all around attitude. I can have a really, you know, I have a team that come to work every day and sit with another every day and have a really crap attitude and deliver the bare minimum possible. I can have a team that I've never met one another. They believe in what they're doing is important to the world. And I never have to question who's online, because it doesn't matter. We know what we're working for. So I think our attitude as leaders to trust is going to determine things a lot more than who's remote.
This is interesting. And you mentioned the you know, looking at, for example, Slack to see, you know, how much the teams interact the members of the team interact with one another. I guess they're also, as leaders, we also need to be careful of the opposite, and which is, you know, too many interrupts for the team, not allowing them to, you know, enter the flow, focus on the task at hand. I guess we need to find a balance. It's probably the same if everyone was co-located, you know, everyone is open to interrupts from everybody. But I suppose Slack kind of augments that aspect.
Well, not really. If you, I mean, you can have a private Slack channel for your team.
Yeah.
And a public Slack channel for your users accessing the team, and you can turn one to silent and the other not. So the way that we can filter information today is 10 times better than it was pre-COVID. I mean, I love the idea of the Pomodoro technique, where for 22 minutes you just concentrate on a particular piece of work, and then at the end of that you stop and recalibrate. How often do I need to go and look at alternative Slack channels? You know, a lot of organized teams work within a matrix structure where they work for a team, but then they also work for a practice or a skill set. So, you know, you can't do both at the same time. One should always be more prime than the second, but in the end, it's about balance. We can allocate time so much easier these days to create that balance. I think the ability to filter information now is great. I think some people are attracted to noise, right? And actually want their lives to be noisy, because then they think they're important. I don't think that's the way that you work. I think you work smart. And sometimes you know, there's certain noise that you filter out, but you don't ignore it forever. You kind of have to check in. So how often do you check in? Daily? Hourly? It's all dependent on how important the work is. That's the reason why I think measurement is so important. You need to measure your level of disruption. You need to measure your level of context switching, because that will then determine if you should keep doing it or not.
Talking about attitudes, so I'm wondering, when you go to companies, right, and how do you make sure that they stick with that mindset and those principles once you leave, when you're not there anymore, so they can keep doing it by themselves?
It's definitely the hardest part of consulting, and it usually depends on how much time you have. You know, are you working full time? Are you working 1 hour or 1 day a week? Are you just coming in every quarter for a couple of days? Well, you know, tenure has a lot to do with it. So normally how it works with me is that I may come in for a day, and a member of my team will come in full time, and we try to make sure that we capture some of what we're doing in videos and in Confluence in a way that is accessible to anybody. I think the most important thing, though, is what we need to do is we need to make sure that the product owner or the scrum master will always will keep the beliefs going no matter what. So if we don't have strong leadership, all knowledge gets lost quickly. So I put a lot of effort into trying to get leaders to know where we have codified like a build pipeline, where we've worked on a particular mirror board on, I know, how we're interpreting the values of the organization. I think you kind of have to make sure that those kind of reference points are there, and that when someone joins, they can access it reasonably quickly. So when someone joins, we have a mirror board, which is a welcome board, and when you go onto the welcome board, there's a couple of videos, and then there's all of these places you can go next. And you know, the first thing we ask, you know, let us know when you have your first kind of question. So I think you kind of have to. We try to not just push lots of information down someone's throat, or to define everything as process. what we try to do is encourage curiosity inquiry. So when you go onto the mirror board, it doesn't have all the information. It actually encourages you to go and ask certain people. So it's every trail, every breadcrumb comes to asking somebody the next question. And remember, knowledge in a social entity doesn't reside within a single individual or a single artifact. It's in the conversations. It's in the day-to-day ways of going about work. It's in our attitude to quality. It's also in our attitude to listening. That's going to be far more informative to anybody. And I think that's what we try to do. We try to create that cultures on the ceremonies being pretty strong. The one that I've put a lot of effort into these days is the quarterly review. The quarterly review, it's almost like a sacred time for the business. And as a result, no senior member of the business would not want to be there. And as a result, neither should. And so as a result, so should you. And I think that has been, I'm working with one organization and the quarterly review now is bigger than anybody. And yeah, you know, it's actually happening next week and I'm not there and I'm pretty comfortable because it's a lot bigger than me.
This is, I guess the review in general, the retrospective is an important aspect of Agile. I feel like sometimes the organization does not help the teams sort of stick to, you know, whatever maybe action items they have identified as part of their retrospective to improve. You know, maybe the team doesn't have enough sort of confidence that they can actually allocate resources to working on those action items versus the regular day-to-day, you know, backlog, for example. What do you think of this? Do you have any, I don't know, any input on this?
Sure, yeah. So the first thing is that anything that you wish to do as a result of your retrospective, there's meant to be some correlation to a negative impact. Like anything we try to do, it's to try and make something better, right? So, for example, technical debt. In a retrospective, we decided we want to do some refactoring here, and here. So the question is, how do you make refactoring valuable? So, you know, one of the ways that I like to do is I create a 2x2 table. And in that table, I have feature families as the columns. And the rows are technical domains or platforms or functions. And I put smiley faces, sad faces, all sorts of faces into the boxes. And I have this taxonomy that says, if it's a sad face, when you give something a story point of one, it can be 1 to 1.5. So I have a multiplier. If I had a straight line face, the multiplier is 1.3. And the idea then is if we take technical debt out, I should be able to see some of those multiplier sad faces come off the board and replaced with happy faces, which is no impact. So that's one way that I've tried to create technical debt as something that everybody cares about. Because everybody wants to have a happy system. And I have one, so my multiplier is getting, the highest one I have is x5. And we have a tombstone on that one, which means if we even try to touch this code, you know, God help us, we don't know what's going to happen next. So, and I think just, you know, saying when we're going to do something and here's the impact it's going to have is easier than saying, can you give us some time to work on something that we care about? And you just have to trust us. So I like to try and make sure that anything from a retrospective that we're going to focus on is to actually to do something better for everybody. So I try to make sure that we're able to explain it.
Exactly. I think that's the key point, being able to explain it and make sure that the audience understands the impact. Yeah.
I can tell you now, the worst thing that I've ever seen engineering teams do, and I think they do it way too often, is they try to guilt people into submission. You should let us do this because all the other companies in the world let us do it. Or we're really bad. You should allow us to do this. or you know, you holding us back is you, any of this kind of sense of kind of placing guilt or shame to try and gain control, I feel is wrong. Yes, not everybody is going to be a technical practitioner, but technical practitioners can also help people to become more understanding of what it takes to write software.
I guess a concern that I usually have is, you know, whenever a team acknowledges that there is some important technical issue to resolve, you know, they need to be really deliberate about the way they frame that initiative to the rest of the organization.
So I'll give you one more example. I don't believe in technical stories.
Agreed. Absolutely.
There's no such thing. I expect any technical story, you should be able to look at a CIO or a CTO's job description, and you should be able to connect it to that. So I try to get technical work and attribute to the technical ownership. So if you look at the KPIs of CIO, I usually am able to kind of articulate the value of doing something technical to that. And I think we sometimes get too attracted to our only customers are the customers of the product owner. We also have other customers, such as, you know, a CIO. Sometimes enterprise architecture, sometimes application support if you're not DevOps. And we have to be able to, you know, relate things to all customers, not just the business one.
That's really interesting, actually, because often we don't think something is worth doing because it doesn't have a direct business customer sort of impact. But instead, you know, as you said, there are many customers. So we should be able to write a story, you know, targeting that specific type of customer, you know, that we're doing this for.
Well, you know, like, let's just think about something like, I don't know, your entire system going down. Let's just say we have a website, and if our website went down for 4 hours, who would react first? Would it be our customer or would it be your CIO? Well, I can tell you now the CIO would be reacting pretty quickly, because they usually have KPIs around, performance, right? They're probably the first to get the warning. So I think you usually get the warning out of the CIO office faster than a customer complaint. Okay. So do we have to wait for customers to complain, or should we jump when the CIO notices something? I worked with an organization and they had a Sev 1, and it occurred because the disk space got beyond 99%. So we had warnings about disk space for 6 weeks, but people just stopped noticing them.
Yeah, became noise, I guess.
Yeah, it was just noise. So, if we place alerts in our system, they're meant to be important, right? So who's the customer of those alerts? If we have alerts in a system that nobody's noticing, I think you've missed a customer base.
That's a great way, a great lens to look, you know, this kind of things through, yeah.
We would like to ask you, at the end of this episode, about some resources, maybe book or a podcast or articles or websites that our audience can look at to know more about the topics.
So I think for me, there's one book that I feel has been the most powerful in my life in trying to understand shared understanding and common understanding, common agreement, I think is the second term. The book is called On Dialogue by David Bloom. It's a very skinny, small book. And for me, that's where I started to see the disjoint between sometimes dev teams and the whole of business team. And it was the place where I learned that subcultures can have a detrimental impact to purpose. So that would be the first thing I'd encourage you to have a look at. This is a strange one, but I think it's really good to have a subscription to something, even if it's just InfoQ, where you're just getting new insights regularly.
Absolutely.
And InfoQ is an excellent resource for someone who can't afford to spend a lot of money, right? You'll never be able to read everything on InfoQ. It's all consuming, but you'll be able to keep up with the times. You'll be able to chase topics. And I would encourage your listeners to start just paying attention to InfoQ again, because it's a wealth of information.
That's great.
Yeah. I have no job in InfoQ or anything. There's nothing in this for me, but I've definitely seen that as really helpful. And if you really want to become better at speaking up through the organization, I think starting to read Harvard Business Review, really important, because the language of executive is not the language of a team. And we have to figure out ways to kind of connect. I find there's always an article or two, sometimes written 10 years ago, that I'll read and it'll just give me that snippet that I needed to have the conversation with somebody else. It also shows that I've done a little bit of research and I'm putting some effort into this. I'm not just doing it out of my own will. The other one, I'll leave with this. I think the biggest thing that's going to change in engineering, software engineering, over the next 10 years is flow metrics. I think flow metrics is going to become a very big thing. And I think the sooner we start measuring it as a standard, the better. And it's the flow of features that we measure at the flow stories. There's a book called Project to Product. That's a bit of gold.
It's been such a pleasure to have you, Martin, to discuss these aspects with you. And we look forward to speaking to you again, actually.
Well, guys, lovely to meet you.